My name is Hans Falterholz, and I'm the local Russian here in the village. Not really. I'm from Concordia College in Portland, Oregon, and have been teaching both English and literature there and some theology. And I guess of all of the literary figures that I've had the privilege of digging around in, none has continued to be both perplexing and challenging, inspiring and terrifying like Dostoevsky has. And so it's a particular joy and also somewhat awesome thing for me to venture into one of my favorite Dostoevsky novels, Crime and Punishment. And I thought that one way of introducing him would be to say a little bit about how he has influenced other people, and that may give you some idea of the kind of impact that he has had in our Western culture. But before I do that, I'm curious how many of you here have read Crime and Punishment? Can I see hands? Okay, great. And
I'm not asking which year.
No comments about which year or anything like that. And have any of you ever seen a movie? There have been several versions of Crime and Punishment out. Anybody? Okay, did any of you see Brothers Karamazov some years ago, movie version? With Yul Brynner, and who was it? That gal who played Grushenka, the blonde, Maria Schell? Yeah, okay. Oh, parenthetically, it has nothing to do with what we're talking about. One time, Gil Shedler and I were walking down Broadway, and we were going to see Sidney Poitier in Lorraine Hansberry's Raisin in the Sun. And it was a tremendous performance, and it was great to see Sidney Poitier in the flesh. He's as terrific as he is in the movies, even more so in the flesh. And as we were walking out of the theater, there was Maria Schell right next to us on a date. And we completely forgot the play because there was Maria Schell. And she played Grushenka. At any rate, Dostoevsky is known for novels like Crime and Punishment, Brothers Karamazov, and so on. But he has had a tremendous impact on people in all sorts of fields. For example, when a person by the name of Hubben writes a contemporary book on four prophets of our destiny, he will put in a man like Kierkegaard, Kafka, Dostoevsky, and one other person. So he falls into that kind of constellation. Evidently one of the great existential thinkers of our age. Or when a person like Nathan Scott tries to chart what the great modern figures are in modern literature, who does he start out with but Dostoevsky? And then he moves right up to the present to people like James Joyce and Samuel Beckett. Well, that's a really interesting thing because Dostoevsky is a contemporary with people like Charles Dickens and, in part Walter Scott and so on. So Dostoevsky reaches way back into the middle of the 19th century, and it's amazing that of all those 19th century writers, he's the one figure that is still considered modern. I was going to read you a section from Crime and Punishment where they're debating the women's rights issue. And you'd think it was written yesterday. And it's unbelievable. And that was already 100 years ago. This novel was written in 1866-67. Here are a couple of quotations. Sartre, the great French existentialist, says, "All of existentialism is rooted in Ivan Karamazov's statement, if God is dead, then all is permitted." Berdyaev, Nicholas Berdyaev, a Russian philosopher and a historian and a great admirer of Dostoevsky, wrote a neat little book out in paperback now, which gives you one of the best summaries of the philosophical and theological thought of Dostoevsky. Outstanding, Berdyaev. He says that no one is Dostoevsky's equal. That is to say, he ranks with and above Dante and Shakespeare. Those are high claims, and I guess what we have to do is read Dostoevsky to see if he lives up to him. Nietzsche. I had a student who had a smattering of Nietzsche in philosophy class and then came and read Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment with me. And one of the theories for Raskolnikov's crime is that there are two types of people. There are the people who follow the herd, who do what is supposed to do, and then there are those rare people who can transcend the normal laws and moralities of mankind. They are the lords. A German Herrenmoral and Herdenmoral, herd morality and lord morality. And this student said, aha, I'm going to write a paper and show that Dostoevsky got all his ideas from Nietzsche, because that's Nietzsche's idea. And I said to her, well, be sure you check out the dates and all of that when you work that thesis out. And so she worked out this paper and got it all figured out and failed to check out the dates. And it was, she was outraged when I told her that it was in fact the other way around. Here's a quote from Nietzsche. All the psychology I learned came from Dostoevsky. Which came first, the chicken or the egg? Freud, entering medical school in 1881, the year Dostoevsky died. Everything I've ever done was already done by Dostoevsky. He wrote a well-known essay on the patricide in Brothers Karamazov. Great novel where there are three brothers and then there's also a half-brother and one of them kills the father. The question is who? But one of them wished his father's death. And that was maybe even worse than the one who actually killed the father. And so Freud wrote a long essay and shows how the Oedipus complex is functioning profoundly in Brothers Karamazov. And in any case, lists Brothers Karamazov with other works as great as Oedipus and Hamlet. Lenin read Dostoevsky. Dostoevsky, he says, is repulsive, but great. Dostoevsky stood for everything that Lenin hated, and vice versa. For 30 years after the Russian Revolution in 1917, Dostoevsky was virtually banned, only available in textbooks. And it was first in 1956. If you know anything about Russian history, you know that's the year of the thaw, the great thaw, when things started loosening up. Did they begin to publish popular works of Dostoevsky? And even to this day, there's a tremendous debate in Russian literary criticism, because they take literature very seriously, as to how kosher Dostoevsky really is. And many people say his greatness is in that he shows the effects of the insurgent capitalist society. And Crime and Punishment is a great novel because it shows the effects of a city and of the beginning capitalism in a city on a character like Dostoevsky. But it's also a decadent novel because it spends much too much time in the emotions and feelings and thoughts and guilt complexes of Raskolnikov. Here are a couple of interesting paradoxes. The other great Russian novelist who lives at the same time that Dostoevsky does is Tolstoy. Two men who never met each other. Many people feel they almost deliberately avoided each other. Tolstoy read Dostoevsky's novels. Dostoevsky read Tolstoy's novels. The interesting thing is that Dostoevsky's fame grew and Tolstoy's fame has declined over the years. somehow Dostoevsky is still very much our own soulmate, at least if we have any sense of angst, anxiety, like some of us freaky people do. And Tolstoy is great, but in the great realist tradition. Here's another interesting thing about Dostoevsky. He stands for everything that many of us today would reject. He hated Jews, Germans, French, English, Catholics, Protestants. He was a bigot. Wasiolek, who was the editor of Dostoevsky's notebooks, says he's a jingoist nationalist. He had some crazy ideas about Russian messianism. He felt that Russia was somehow going to save the world. Oh my gosh. Russia going to save the world. We are, maybe, used to be, liberal, international, humanitarian. He was just the opposite. He got more and more conservative. He was wildly a Slavophil. He had deep questions about people who were motivated by great humanitarian motives. And he, as a person, lived a wild life. His wife is at home dying of consumption, and Dostoevsky is in Germany chasing after Paulina Soslova, a beautiful girl who was torturing him and tormenting him, and every time he nearly tried to get a hold of her, she pulled away from him. I don't know if they ever consummated their affair, but he was chasing her all over Europe. And his wife is dying of consumption in Russia. Not only is he chasing her all over Europe, but he's gambling his money away, and he sends telegraphs back to his wife, send me more money. Right? And in fact, it's one of those moments where he's in Baden-Baden at the gambling tables, and he's out of money, and he's lying in his hotel room, that the idea for his novel got germinated. There he's lying in a little room, he's without money, and supposing there was some really repulsive, worthless person in society who had a lot of money, and in fact got that money in a very bad way by gouging other people. Supposing, after all, if God is dead and everything is permitted, we just killed her and used that money to get a new start, and then from then on dedicated our whole life to humanity. Wouldn't it be worth it? Now, out of that germ idea in that room in Baden-Baden is how this novel has its, in a sense, genesis, at least one aspect of it. A little bit of a flavor of some things about Dostoevsky as a kind of an introduction to him as a person. An intriguing character. Maybe one or two other opening observations, and then I'd like to tell the story a little bit in summary fashion, then we'll perhaps open it up for some discussion, and you may want to say, let's talk about this, or let's talk about that. Who is interested in Dostoevsky? Interestingly enough, not just literary critics. Lawyers have studied Dostoevsky and his insight into law and the psychology of the criminal. Philosophers have studied Dostoevsky in his intense debate with Chernyshevsky, who argued that man does not have free will and that the way to solve society's problems is to engineer, by means of social science, man's best good, a sort of an enlightened John Stuart Mill humanitarianism. Dostoevsky fought that to the death with his own ideas. Philosophers are interested in him. Psychologists are interested in him. In fact, there's a great tradition of psychological interpretation of Dostoevsky. And guess where that tradition has its most widespread place? The United States. We're the great Freudian interpreters of Dostoevsky. The Germans have provided the greatest theological interpretations. If you ask Karl Barth, the great Swiss theologian, who one of his most influential figures was in his own thinking, he names Dostoevsky. Jerry Pelican, Dr. Pelican, I should say, was my teacher and is now at Yale University. Lists Brothers Karamazov as one of the five greatest works that any theologian could read, and that was most influential in his life. Needless to say, the Marxists are extremely interested in Dostoevsky. Now, this is amazing. There are not many authors who range into such a great diversity of areas of interest. Well, perhaps enough on introductory remarks of this sort. The novel itself is, in a sense, a very simple story. It's a story of Raskolnikov, a student impoverished because of lack of financial funds, and in a way weakened and depressed because he hasn't had enough to eat and he isn't sleeping well and he's sort of sickly, who gets it into his head, an idea is picking in his brain, that perhaps the solution to all of his problems is to do away with a pawnbroker lady. And he runs a little trial visit to her room to see how the situation is. And through a number of circumstances, some very freaky chance circumstances, the doors open, and it's almost as if he is forced to go and repeat that trial run. And everything works out just right. He pulls out his axe. He hits her over the head, breaks open her head, and then to his horror, as he's pulling the money out from under her bed and so on, her half-witted sister walks in, and she's an innocent person, but Raskolnikov has to kill her too. And it's a sickening blow as he brings the axe down on her head, and he's in a complete delirium by this point. Forgets to lock the door, and all of a sudden there are people coming up the stairs. And he rapidly goes over and shuts the door, and he stands behind that door trembling, and he hears these two men talking out there and saying, "I wonder where that old woman is, and why isn't she in, and she's usually in here." And then they say, "Well, let's try the door again," and they rattle it, and they say, "Wait a minute, it's locked by the little latch. She must be in there." They rattle some more. Something's wrong. And poor Raskolnikov is trembling in his boots. And they say, "Well, we better go and get someone." And both of them, get this, how stupid can you get, trot down the stairs to look for someone. So Raskolnikov stands there and finally decides to bolt down the door, down the stairway. He's up on, I think, the fourth or fifth floor, down, down, down. And he's almost out, and all of a sudden there's someone coming up the stairs. So he goes back up again. Now what to do? And suddenly there just happens to be a door open. He pops in, stands behind the door because there are some people painting an apartment that's just been vacated. And he's standing there trembling as they go past him. And then he zips out. And normally when you go out a door, there are always people standing around, but there's this great big hay wagon. So he's behind that, and he gets by without anyone seeing him. And then he retraces his steps. No one sees him. He has his bloody axe in his pocket, for which he had made a sling. He tries to figure out how to get rid of that. Then finally, he's able even to do that without being seen. He takes it back into the porter's room of the place where he's living. And fortunately, the porter doesn't have to be there. He goes past his landlady's door, which is always open, and she's always there, and she's not there. And he gets back into his room trembling like this, partly because no one has seen him. And he had this all planned out so well, and everything went wrong, and yet everything went right. And he has committed the perfect crime. Well, the long and short of it is that for various and sundry reasons, this experiment in overstepping the bounds failed. And that's really what the whole first half of the novel is about. In fact, very early in the story, He's in such inner turmoil and despair and delirium. He lies in his room, I think, for about 3 days, and the girl who brings up tea and bread feeds him in his delirium, and he's been mumbling all sorts of crazy things, and they talk to him about that, and that worries him, and so on. He finally gets more or less well, goes out, and has a compulsion to tell somebody the whole story. And so he meets somebody from the police office in a tavern, whom he had met earlier, and he says to him, what would you give, or what would you think if I would tell you who committed that murder? And he says, oh, you're crazy. And he says, I know who did it. Ha ha, I bet you think I did it. Of course I didn't do it. But what would you think if I told you I did do it? And he goes on like that and goes through a mock confession. And it's terrifying. And one of the things that's so terrifying is there's a certain point of this whole story that he can't stop himself anymore. And there are other points that he is just absolutely wild in exuberance, and he wants to stick out his tongue at Zamatov. And he says, I bet you think I really did it, don't you? Ha ha, I trapped you. And this goes on, and finally Zamatov, who's completely out of his wits, tears out of the tavern. Raskolnikov's good friend Razumikin comes in and says, what are you doing here? You're supposed to be in your room. You're sick. And Raskolnikov says, leave me alone. I don't want you. And I can get along by myself. And Razumikin says to him, this is his good friend, listen, you can't get along by yourself at all. You can't even get home. And he says, well, come along with me and you'll hear the whole story. And then somebody shakes Razumikin off. He stops at a bridge and he looks over and he says, this is it. I just can't go on. And at that moment, there's a thud, and he looks down, and a woman has jumped over. A lot of people committed suicide in Petersburg in those days. And a woman had just jumped over the bridge. And some people said, woman overboard, and other people said, quick, get a boat, and they go down and rescue her. The idea is she doesn't want to be rescued. They don't even let her commit suicide. It's a really depressing scene. And at that point, Raskolnikov somehow decides against suicide, and he turns around and he's going to turn himself in. And he's standing in the middle of the street, and he doesn't know which way to do, and he wishes somebody would say something to him, a voice would come, something would happen. He's waiting for something, and nothing happens, no voice comes, and he stands, and it's terrible. There's total isolation. And at that moment, just by chance, there's a hullabaloo down the street, there's an accident, and someone Raskolnikov had met earlier in a tavern by the name of Marmeladov, an old drunkard, has just been run over. Raskolnikov had befriended him, and now here Marmeladov has been run over and he's dying. He helps take him home, and there he meets the daughter of Marmeladov, Sonia, a very young, innocent, 18-year-old girl who has been driven to prostitution because of her father's drunkenness and squandering the only source of income for the family. And when Raskolnikov meets her, she has an unconditional love toward everyone, including her father, whereas the mother really blames the father for destroying the whole family. And it's a very touching scene when Marmeladov sees his daughter come in, and he says something like, Sonia, daughter, forgive me. And she embraces him, and that's a very touching moment, because he really means that, and she really forgives him. And then a priest comes in, and he says his last confession, and the mother is very angry. And the priest says, you've got to forgive. And she says, forgiveness, what does that mean? That's just empty words. And you sense she's right in a way. But yet forgiveness happened between Sonia and the father. Well, all of this is in an interlude, and somehow it gives Raskolnikov a new lease on life. And he says, all of that delirium, that was just weakness. I want to live, and I'll show them. And now a whole new Raskolnikov arises. And he thinks he's going to show them. But by the end of the first half of the novel, Someone else has appeared on the scene, a man by the name of Svidrigaïlov, a really evil kind of character. And he meets Raskolnikov in his room, and we sense, because of something that happens there, that Raskolnikov knows he can't get away from it all. And what happens is, Raskolnikov lies delirious in his room, and he can't quite remember how he got out on the street, but he's walking toward the house again where he committed the murder. He goes up the stairs. He doesn't want to, but he goes up the stairs. He opens the door. He rattles the doorbell in the very same way, and there is the landlady again. And he pulls out his axe, and she just comes at him, and she's sort of half twinkling in his eye, in her eye, and he takes the axe and he hits her over the head, and she just laughs. And he takes the axe and he hits her again and again, and she laughs at him. And he doesn't know what to do, and he's terrified, and he turns around and he looks down the stairs, and there are all sorts of voices and people staring up and laughing at him and laughing at him, and he can hardly stand it, and he shakes himself, and all of a sudden he wakes up. And it had just been a nightmare. Dostoevsky does that in his fiction. He gets us into a dream, and we don't even know when the dream starts. It's very moving. First time you read it, you wonder what's going on. And at that moment, there's a little snicker on the threshold, and there stands Svidrigaïlov. So that's the end of the first half of the novel. And from here on in, the only question for Raskolnikov is, how is he going to escape? And there seem to be two ways. One is Sonya, who is going to say to him, why don't you turn yourself in? Why don't you confess? And he says, I can never do that and be a man. Svidrigaïlov, on the other hand, says, why don't you just take off for America? And what that really means is, why don't you commit suicide? And in effect, that's what Svidrigaïlov does himself at the end. He's a man totally overcome with boredom, totally bored with life. He can have anything he wants. He has violated, he has done some terrible things. Almost violated Raskolnikov's sister, Dunya, and just is a beastly man. There's a very, almost melodramatic scene in the end of the novel where Dunya and Svidrigaïlov get together in a bedroom, and you know what he wants, and Dunya has a pistol and she shoots at him and she misses him and all sorts of things happen. At any rate, she gets away, and at the end Svidrigaïlov takes his own life. He is the only person who knows, other than the family and immediate people who are close to Raskolnikov, that Raskolnikov killed the two women. The police chief who's hunting him, Porfiry, has only circumstantial evidence. There are some very exciting moments where he seems to have someone as evidence who saw Raskolnikov go back to the scene of the crime. And the police chief, in a very dramatic moment of interrogation, is about to spring this man from the underground, bronze man as he's called, on him. And at that moment in the police office, a totally unexpected thing happens. And that is, some guy comes in and says, I did it, I did it. Someone confesses the crime. His name is Mikulka, and he is one of the painters. And somehow he has a guilty conscience, and he's got himself talked into the fact that he's committed the crime. Porfiry is very sharp. He knows he hasn't. But what can he do? Here's a man who's come in and says he's committed the crime. So he has to dismiss this person who saw Raskolnikov and overheard him ask questions back in the room where the crime had been committed and ring the doorbell again. And that man comes back to Raskolnikov that night in his room and says to him, I owe you a deep apology. I thought you committed the murder. I am an evil man because I suspected you. Will you forgive me? And Raskolnikov, absolutely speechless. Okay, so here we are at the end of the novel. Raskolnikov has talked to Sonya several times. There have been two very, very moving moments where they've encountered each other. One is, Sonya has read to him the story that's most meaningful for her. Raskolnikov sometimes torments her. He can be very vicious because he's so brilliant. And he says, Sonia, the way you're going, you have just one of three alternatives. Either you're going to become depraved, just like any other harlot. Right now, she is, in a sense, pure. She's a saint. Or you're going to go crazy, or you're going to commit suicide. How can you go on? And she says, the only reason I can go on is because I know God is there and with me. And he says, you're out of your mind. How do you keep going? And then he forces her to read what makes her keep going. And she doesn't want to do it. It's almost like a psychological violation of her innermost self. But he makes her do it. And it's a very moving moment. They're just with one little candle in a room with only a bare bed and two chairs. And she reads the story of the resurrection of Lazarus. Very, very touching moment. Right in the middle of this novel, that story. The other moving moment is Raskolnikov confesses to her, and she is horrified by what he's done. But instead of saying, what a terrible thing you've done to that woman, she says, what have you done to yourself? Isn't that something? What have you done to yourself? And then she says, you must go out to the crossroads, you must kiss the ground, and you must stand up and you must proclaim to the whole world, I am a murderer. And he goes out to the crossroads and he kisses the ground and he stands up and he almost says, I'm a murderer. And some people are there and they say, oh, look at this fellow, what he's doing, and isn't that crazy? And he's ashamed and he doesn't do it. And so we're never sure, has he really confessed? Has he turned himself, where is he at? And we're not sure. And then after Svidrigailov commits suicide, for some reason or other, Raskolnikov turns himself in to the police office, and that's where the story ends. And there's the trial and the epilogue. They send him off to Siberia, and there we learn that he still says, my only mistake was I made a blunder. I was weak. I started trembling. But if I would have been strong, I could have pulled it off. And Sonia has followed him, and she's out there with him for a long time. She gets very sick. The prisoners almost kill him because somehow he thinks he's better than they are. And then he has a terrible dream about microbes. And way at the end of the epilogue, when Sonia almost has died, and he really misses her, even though he doesn't want to miss her and wants to be totally an independent person, he suddenly is overwhelmed when she comes back to him by a feeling which he can't understand. And he falls at her feet and recognizes somehow that everything has been all wrong, and then a new life begins for him. And Dostoevsky says, but of course that's the beginning of a new story. And that's where we have to leave this story. Now that's a kind of review of the novel. There are a lot of things I left out. I jumped around a little bit, but I hope you get something of a feel of the story. And I think at this point, the only thing that I would like to say is this, that probably the greatest mystery, at least for many people, is why Raskolnikov does what he does. And they're basically three big interpretations that he offers himself for his crime. One is that he's poor, impoverished, sick. In a sense, circumstances necessitated his doing the crime. And now another theory is that he comes up with himself. It's called a humanitarian theory. And that is, just think of the good that could be done, since she's a louse, to eradicate her. And then with that life, to get a new start, go to the university. He had a dropout from university. He was a very promising, brilliant student. And then, for the rest of his life, commit himself to doing good deeds for humanity. And then he had a third theory, the so-called Napoleonic theory, namely that there are some people, like Napoleon, they are men of action, and they can ruthlessly spill the blood of thousands of people. And it's okay. because they have a great task for society. They are a different kind of people. There are two. There's not just man or humanity. There are two kinds. There are those people who are above the law, and then there are the rest of you peons. And Raskolnikov is going to see if he is in that category. He likes to think he is, and he's going to step over this little boundary that you're not supposed to kill. He's going to try that experiment. Why not? Let's see what it's like. Now, one astute literary critic, Morris Beebe, has said there's an underlying motive, and that's Dostoevsky's great theme of suffering. And that is that man wants to suffer. Maybe Raskolnikov is motivated by that inner impulse. Suffering. Maybe there he's akin to the great Greek tragedians, like Aeschylus, who says, "Pathe mathe, suffering teaches." Suffering teaches wisdom. Well, how about stopping there, and throwing the ball to you. Do you want to ask any questions just about what went on in the story? Maybe about some of the names, just some really obvious things, especially if you haven't heard it before. You know, some of you have read it. You may want to say, I think you ought to add this and this and that and that, and that would be a good idea too. And then maybe let's talk a little bit after that. So just to get some of the things straight, maybe how to pronounce those names. They're terrible. I've taught this novel a couple of times to students, and we often spend 10 minutes just going over the names, saying Svidrigaylov about 7 times. It's a tough name to say. But, yeah, sir?
I was going to ask, I've read half the book, but I don't remember if you got the money or not.
Well, that's a marvelous thing. He left a lot of it there, but he shoved some of a few trinkets in his pockets and so on, and he gets called to the police station the first day. And he's terrified. They already are on to him. And he's in the police station trembling like a leaf. And then it turns out that they have an IOU from his landlady. He hasn't paid his rent. Now, Dostoevsky does that type of suspense. And you know, you get into it, and you, with him, you're just terrified. And now he feels very proud, and he starts talking, and he makes nice speeches, and he's just right on top of the world. And all of a sudden, he overhears a conversation about two painters who know something about a murder outside the door. And he faints in the police office. And then when he recovers, he goes home. And the first thing he does is he wonders, did they search the place? And he looks for all of the remnants, his bloody sock, and he had hid some of the stuff away. He lives in a fifth floor underneath the eaves of a roof, and he has a little hole in the floor, and he hid stuff in there, and he pulls it all out, and he has a little bit of money. And the first thing he does is he goes down the street, walks through Petersburg, and he finally finds a little room, and not a room, what is it? Kind of a courtyard. What it really is a urinal. If you've ever been in Europe, you know how these walls are like that? Like in Italy, southern Italy and France, the men just stand there, that's all. It's a carriage urinal. And there's a great big wheel from an old millstone. And he lifts that thing up, there's a little hole under there, and he dumps everything in. Never even looks to see what he stole. Just dumps it in. Later on, he tells that at the trial, and the lawyers say he's lying. Psychologically, obviously he's lying. No criminal would take goods and not see what he stole. Yeah, and not use it. Yeah.
I guess the criminology behind it, where the murder, the person that commits the crime will return to the scene of the crime.
Marvelous.
Is what he faces right there. And I think anyone that experiences that goes through it either physically or psychologically in one way or another, that they return to the scene. That's what I'm thinking about.
Yeah.
All that. works with him locally. Because he does have, he has to tell someone. He has to share.
It's a very, it's a great scene. Yeah, that's a scene to read and reread where he goes back to the crime, to the scene of the crime. He goes upstairs and fellows are painting. And the first thing is, there's this kind of pale lavender wallpaper up there. And the other wallpaper was a sickly yellow. That's, by the way, that's the color of this novel, yellow. The pawnbroker lady's neck is like the neck of a, I mean, like the leg of a yellow chicken, the yellow leg of a chicken. Not a nice metaphor. She has yellow white hair. Everything is yellow. Very interesting color. By the way, yellow is the passport that a prostitute has to carry. She carries a yellow tag.
Hmm.
Right? So Raskolnikov comes up, and it's a pale lavender. What's his reaction? He's outraged that they, this is a gut-level feeling, of course, that they dare to change it. What is that psychology? And then he says to the workman, did you realize there was a pool of blood here? He's saying things he doesn't even want to say. And he asks them all sorts of questions and so on, and they said, what's wrong with you? And he says, do you want to find out? They said, no, we don't want to find out. He says, well, if you want to find out, why don't you take me to the police station? And as he walks out the door, he rings the doorbell once. And he rings it a second time. And he has to ring it a third time, just as he did the time that he went to kill that lady. Now talk about repeating. And then Dostoevsky not only has him go back to the scene of the crime, but he goes back in that horrible dream, which I reenacted earlier.
I'm wondering, it seems to me, as I remember reading it, that he plans it and says it's all theoretical. And then he does it without ever intending doing it. It's as if he says, it happens to you. And I'm very interested in the business of, is this unintended for you? At what point do people start doing things that they say they won't do?
Well, isn't one of the things that we see in a lot of law, when a person kills somebody, what do they say?
What is the term they use?
He was temporary insanity, which is a way, I think, of exonerating him, from judicial responsibility. Is that right? And at any rate, that happens to Raskolnikov. It's almost as if he's no longer in control of himself. And how Dostoevsky manages that is magnificent. One place he uses an interesting metaphor, Raskolnikov's thought says, now he felt as if he were like a piece of, like a rag in a wringer in a washing machine, which once you get into it, you can no longer get out. Yeah.
What does this say to us in terms of when you start tension, or when do people start?
Yeah, Hans, I think the ultimate test is probably in terms of irresistible impulse. The test probably is, would this act have been committed had the constable been there?
Even at the point where he's embarked upon the course, does he continue on the course?
Well, it's very important, I think, for Dostoevsky to make the circumstances such that, in a sense, there's a maximum of freedom. In other words, there are no restraining circumstances. Everything works out by right, just right, but by chance, not by his intellect. And the whole point of this, as you rightly say, is he wanted to be a man of action who thinks through his plan and then carries it out. And in spite of himself, he completely falls apart and ends up going strictly by instinct and in a way in a mesmerized state. So in a sense there has to be a maximum freedom, but on the other hand there has to be a maximum compulsion. And of course that's what drives the critics right up the wall.
So that one great essay by a fellow by the name of, a bad name, Snodgrass, but a very good essay, argues that Raskolnikov is guilty and commits the crime for that reason. Isn't that something? He already feels guilty for whatever reason, and he has some very interesting theories about that, and commits the crime to relieve his feeling of guilt. And many people say that's one of the best essays that's been written. Now, you know, I have my own little thesis about this. And I'm not sure if I should get into that here, but maybe I should a little bit. One of the very important relations that I completely skipped over is Raskolnikov's relationship to his mother. And his mother writes him a letter and says, "Dear Rodion, we are so worried about you, and I am sacrificing for you, and here is some more money, and I hope this will help you. And I want you to know that your sister Dunya is going to get married to a certain man by the name of Lozin. Now, he seems to be a generous, kind man, and we have felt that this would be best for us all, and that once she's established, you'll be able to continue your education, and we're going to be coming to Petersburg, and we're so looking forward to seeing you." And it sounds so nice when we read this letter. And then, the next chapter, Dostoevsky writes what's got to be one of the most brilliant chapters that I've ever seen. Because Dostoevsky, Raskolnikov, the student, goes back over that letter, and the very first sentence is something like this: he was outraged at this letter. Outraged, we say, how come? Then he goes back over the letter and anatomizes it bit by bit. And let's see, on one of my slips of paper I tried to write down, maybe I could just read to you a few of the things which infuriate him. One of them is, all of this I put into the area of violation of personal rights. See, he's a very sensitive young man, and he feels his personal rights have been violated. And what are they? Here's one of them. Violation of this inarticulable trust. Namely, all family decisions should somehow be familially discussed. There should be corporate decision-making, not unilateral decision-making, especially when it involves him. Second thing is, Raskolnikov resents bitterly that his mother consents to the engagement because it's an engagement of convenience and they're bartering Dunya away. A third thing, he's outraged because Lozin makes, quote, a commercial transaction of the most intimate of human relationships, marriage. And he ends up by saying, "Oh, living hearts, without any notion of justice." By the way, little clue, for me, this is an extremely interesting chapter. A lot of modern writers say one of the characteristics of our whole modern world is relativism of values. There are no moral absolutes. And who is one of the great writers that they use to endorse this notion? You know, all modern literature shows this. Dostoevsky. Again and again, critics say this. Now, sure, Raskolnikov at other times toys with the idea that everything is permitted. But look at this. When his sister is doing something, and his mother, that violates his personal rights, does he have a keen sense of justice? Now, how can a man turn that off all of a sudden? You see? And I wonder if Dostoevsky hasn't brilliantly showed how that sense of justice is working, not at a rational level, but at a gut feeling level. At any rate, so that is a kind of a long excursus, but I think a very interesting thing. And so I wouldn't argue that Raskolnikov is guilty in a normal sense of the word, but he is deeply resentful and irritated and has a sense of wanting to get even with his mother for the fact that she has violated his personal rights. And maybe there is some kind of a transference in when he kills that lady, pawnbroker lady.
one other interesting sentence. All these little teeny sentences that Dostoevsky slips in the novel are so intriguing. Toward the end of the... Oh, when the mother and Dunya come to Petersburg and they're talking to Razumikin, one of the things that the mother says is something like this: no matter what we do for Raskolnikov, it's not enough. And I think even if I died, it wouldn't be enough. She sort of senses there's something going on. Now, it's all rather subtle, and it's not a big theme, but I think it helps give part of the texture out of which Raskolnikov's own sense of frustration arises. Well, a long discourse. Too much. My apologies. Any other observations, comments, questions, ideas, theories?
Well, I'm not done yet. I got to say at least one more thing. When Raskolnikov talks with Sonia,
you didn't ask me, what do you think is the main motive? There's a section that I have to read to you. It's crucial and extremely interesting, where she wants to know, why did you do it? And he says all sorts of things, like, for example, he says, "Hush, Sonia, I'm not laughing. I know myself that it was the devil that dragged me along. Hush, Sonia," and so on. Now, the interesting thing in this dialogue, he says something, and in the next sentence, he retracts it. So you never know, you're never really sure what he says, and you have to go by intuition. My intuition is this is the place where he comes closest to the truth. After he says all sorts of things, he says this: "If I worried for so long about whether Napoleon would have done it or not, it must be because I felt clearly that I was not Napoleon. I endured all the torment of this endless debating, Sonia, and I longed to shake it off. I longed to kill without casuistry, to kill for my own benefit, and for that alone. I would not lie about it. I would not lie about it even to myself. I did not commit murder to help my mother." That's rubbish. "I did not commit murder in order to use the profit and power I would gain for myself as a benefactor to humanity." Rubbish. "I simply murdered. I murdered for myself, myself alone. And whether I became a benefactor to anyone else or, like a spider, spent the rest of my life catching everybody in my web and sucking the lifeblood out of them, should have been a matter of complete indifference to me at that moment. And most important, it was not money I needed, Sonia. When I killed, it was not money. So much as something else. I know all this now. Understand me. Perhaps, were I to pursue the same course, I should not commit murder again. I needed to experience something different. Something else was pushing me along. What I needed to find out then, and find out as soon as possible, was whether I was a louse like everybody else or a man. Whether I was capable of stepping over the barriers or not. Dared I stoop and take power or not? Was I a trembling creature, or had I the right? ... To kill? Had you the right to kill? Sonia flung up her hands again. That's a great moment. I think it's one of those moments of truth. And later on, he skewers away from that again. Jerry Pelikan once had a lecture about this, Jaroslav Pelikan, and he said the crime is, yes, in part a crime against certain law in society, punishable by crime, to be sure. The crime is familially a crime, to be sure. And in a sense, you could say it's a crime against the fifth commandment. There's a moral violation. But he said the deepest crime, and what's great about this novel, is that it isn't just a crime against society and against its laws, and it's not just a moral crime, but Dostoevsky makes clear somehow, and I think this passage brings it out, that it is finally a crime against the first commandment. See? "I wanted to know if I had the right to kill," says Sonia. There's only one who has a right over life and death. And it's interesting that Raskolnikov here says, "I wanted to know if I was a man and had that right." Man? That's God's prerogative. "Or if I was a louse."
So doesn't this novel raise profoundly the question, what does it mean to be a man?
But what I also hear is that he had a need that he recognized later on, and in order to take care of his need, in the process he killed people, but that really wasn't for the sake of getting money or anything else, but for the sake of living with his own conscience. And then once he realized what he had done, then he really regretted it in a way. I mean, the price he paid to fulfill his need, which probably was never fulfilled, whatever it was the need. Is that on the right track?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, man, the whole question of the motive is the big thing, and I think that the deepest dimension of that is this, is the desire to play God, to save the world. And then, of course, and now the interesting thing is, right down through even to the epilogue, he always insists, my conscience doesn't bother me in the least. My conscience does not bother me. But listen to this, one other very brief sentence. Dunya, my dear, his sister is talking to him and they're reconciled and so on, and she says, I didn't do anything wrong, I just made a blunder. And then he says, parenthesis, if I am guilty, forgive, no, no. He says, if I'm guilty, forgive me, parenthesis. Although, if I am guilty, I cannot be forgiven. It's a profound sentence, I think. Because what he's recognizing here is that what he has done is indeed ultimately culpable. Now, I see at the novel two central issues, justice and forgiveness. And what's so remarkable about Sonia is that she acts out unconditional love to Raskolnikov. She lives out forgiveness. And does that right to Siberia. And that, I think, is the difference for Raskolnikov between suicide and still going on. There's someone who extends to him unconditional love without expecting anything in return.
Even the scene where he gets into the road before the junk gets run over, he wants someone to recognize. He needs someone.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes. But he doesn't want to acknowledge that ever. Never wants to acknowledge it. You know, one of the great ways, and Dostoevsky writes, is he uses body language. And he uses the body. The fact that Raskolnikov collapses should be a signal to him, you know. But he has completely severed his body and his feelings from his actuality. He thinks, oh, it was just my weakness. We all know that's his whole person talking to him, but he can't hear it. I mean, we ought to know that when we're reading the story. Yeah, Stefan?
Well, through much of the book, there's this kind of division somewhere, maybe in between, like, say, theory and his emotions, how he responds to things, that puts him in such turmoil. As you recount that microbe, that dream at the end, is there... Do you think in that dream he comes to some sort of resolution of perhaps bringing together or...
The microbe dream is primarily designed to show what happens if you cut a corner on a fundamental categorical imperative, which ought to be right for everybody, for the sake of a great good. And what it does, it's so horrible a dream, it acts like a mirror to his humanitarian motive, and it exposes its falsity. He himself has to acknowledge the falsity of that. That's one thing that breaks down his intellectual self-justification. But more important, at the gut level, is Sonia's presence when she had almost died. So it's that double thrust, without, you know, recounting it in great detail. Mm-hmm. The most interesting dream is the mare-beating dream. You know that story? He falls asleep under a... he takes a walk and falls asleep under a hedge out on one of the islands in the canals in Petersburg, and he dreams that he's with his father. And they're walking down their country village, and they're going past a little tavern, and his father pulls him along and says, don't look that way. But he can't help looking that way. And what's going on? There is a peasant by the name of Makulka, very drunken, who, with a bunch of his fellows, comes pouring out of the tavern And they get into, he says to all of them, get into the cart. And they get into the cart, and then he starts beating on his horse to get going. And the poor nag takes one step and obviously can't pull all these people. And he gets outraged and he beats the horse some more. And all of his colleagues says, go ahead, let her have it. And some say, oh, the poor thing. And he is more and more enraged. My horse won't pull my men? Why, that so-and-so? You know, and then he finally gets out and he just smashes the horse to bits. And it dies. And the little boy just has tears running out of his eyes. He runs over to the horse. He puts his arms around the horse's head. And he just kisses the horse. And his father tries to pull him away. And he kisses the horse and he cries. And they were going to go to visit somebody's grave. And that's where the dream ends. And he wakes up in a cold sweat. This is before the crime. And what does he say? Is that the way it's going to be when I kill her? Who does he identify with? When he says that, is that the way it's going to be? When I kill her? When I kill her? You know, in all of the ways he says, I'm not really going to kill her. Oh, I'm just thinking about that. You see, he's identified. Obviously with Mikulka. But as we all know, in a sense, we are everybody in our dream. So he is also the little boy. And at that level, he has tremendous compassion and mercy. And that's a part of him that's completely repressed. But who else is he? Also the horse. Yeah, so it's a profound dream. And there's lots you can do with that without going any further at this point. What time is it? Just a comment about the time. Well, we're going to wrap up pretty soon. Maybe a couple of more questions. Any observations, comments, whatever, and then we'll try to wrap it up. Ed? A brief comment about that. A lot of critics see Raskolnikov as a hopelessly split character between reason, intellect, and emotions, feeling, passion. And therefore they see this novel as profoundly tragic in the sense that the ultimate flaw in human existence is in life itself. Right? Life is basically flawed, a tragic vision, a tragic view of life over against what I earlier called an Adamic vision, namely that the flaw is in man and that the world is created good. It's just that we, in our freedom, have brought evil into the world. To be sure, we're tempted. To be sure, circumstances tempt us. But still, finally, we're Adamic in the sense that there's a choice element and freedom is brought into the world. But a lot of critics do not interpret. In fact, most people, if any of you are in college, check out your teachers on Dostoevsky, and I bet 9 out of 10 are going to say it's a tragic vision because life is such that it's thoroughly flawed through and through. And if you want to be free, you obviously have to transgress the limits that man has given us, the grenze situation. In fact, very interesting little thing, another addendum. The title, Crime and Punishment, Crime, Presse to Plainview, is to transgress a limit. And continuously, Raskolnikov wants to know, transgressors step over. He wants to know if he can step over the limit. And it's very interesting. People are always stepping over a threshold, or they're not stepping over, and so on. One of the most, to me, most fundamental questions where there's a terrific difference in interpretation is that, is it a fault of fundamentally tragic interpretation of man, that man is split, and if his intellect wants to develop, he is going to have to do evil? Or is it not that way? And Dostoevsky really, takes that and works it all away. I think his vision is ultimately Adamic. That's my personal conviction, and I could, document that a little bit. Well, the best way I can say it is I think that the split is not the final word. Underlying all that is another thing which Dostoevsky calls life. There's still life. Life is good. And there's something else, there's a communal dimension of life. And that's what Sonia lives out. And that's what Raskolnikov is fighting. He wants to be an individual and go it alone. I don't need you, and I don't need you. I can make it by myself. We don't need each other. Dostoevsky's, one of his deepest convictions is we are all responsible for all. Yeah. Well, Ben, you had a comment.
Well, I just an observation that popped into my mind that the Leopold Loeb theme seems to be somewhat similar to this. Wanted to kill, just to experience, on the experiential level.
Yeah. I'm glad you bring that in. It permits me to make an observation that this isn't just a realistic novel. You know, a lot of us have seen the Leopold and Loeb movie. What was the name of it? Psycho? I guess a lot of us haven't, but anyway. So isn't it Psycho?
No.
It's a horrible movie.
It's an Alfred Hitchcock thing.
Cold Blood? No.
No? Nobody remember. Well, anyway. I think they did it for that, but the interpretation of the movie never brings in the dimension, what I call the religious dimension. That ultimately a sacred bond is violated, or if you will, the first commandment is violated. And what is great about Crime and Punishment is that it brings that in convincingly through a novel without appealing, let's say, to a dogmatic text, i.e. the Bible. In other words, out of the psychology, the sociology, the whole thought process of Raskolnikov, that religious dimension reemerges in this novel. This novel, which is called one of the great modern novels, where God is dead and all values are relative. Which makes it a tremendous statement. Okay. Anybody want to make a closing observation? Well, I hope this may whet your appetite to return to Crime and Punishment and read this or that chapter, his assessment of his mother's letter, or ask yourself, why does he turn himself in the end? And maybe we'll meet again someday to hold and take another look at it. Thanks very much for your participation.
Thank you.